The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, my friends, welcome to another edition of Capital Thinking. It is the day before most of us have a day off for the 4th of July holiday weekend. I know a lot of you are sneaking a glance at the clock wondering, when can I get out of here? When's the boss going to notice that I'm gone? We're going to try and make this next hour pass quickly with some great information on the legal front for you and get you prepared for what's happening in the days and weeks ahead on that front. We've got a great show today. We're going to talk about two key cases from the Supreme Court that came down in just the last week. Then we're going to spend some time talking about oil and gas exploration and what the Obama administration regulations and positions on that mean for domestic production. And we'll wrap up with the hot issues of the day from Washington, D.C. But we're going to start by talking about an interesting campaign finance decision out of the Supreme Court this week. And our guest is a good friend of the show, Bill McGinley from the law firm of Patton Boggs. Bill, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing good, Kevin, and I appreciate you taking the time to have me on.
Great. Well, let's let folks know. Bill McGinley works in campaign finance. He's the former legal counsel to the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and so obviously a guy who's got a great deal of background in the law and has a great deal of personal interest in what the Supreme Court had to say this week about a case called Citizens United. And let's start from the beginning, Bill. Tell us a little bit about who are Citizens United and what were they trying to do that landed them in court?
Sure. Citizens United is a nonprofit organization, and what they had done back in 2007 is produce a feature-length film called Hillary the Movie. And this feature-length film examined the public record of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who was then a candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. As can be expected, the film took a critical view of her public policy and public life during the Clinton years and beyond in the White House. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to sell the movie to cable channels so that the cable subscribers could access the movie in the video on-demand channels. In addition, Citizens United wanted to air some advertisements promoting the film. And since they felt that the FEC would probably come after them, and the FEC is, of course, the Federal Election Commission, which is the federal agency that's charged with regulating and enforcing the federal campaign finance laws, since they felt that there was a threat of prosecution, they went to federal court. And they asked the court for some relief that the federal rules would not apply to the type of film that they created and the advertisements that they wanted to run, because federal law bans corporations, even nonprofit corporations, from airing advertisements that could be construed as expressly advocating the election or defeat of a federal candidate.
And what you're really talking about, Bill, is these guys got themselves sort of in the weeds on McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, right?
That's correct. And they asked the court to basically exempt them from the rules so that they could go ahead and promote the film, sell the film, and then advertise the film's availability.
Now, this case, Bill, didn't they have an argument? I guess what is unique and fascinating to me is everybody knows the Supreme Court sort of backloads its caseload in the last Monday of June, right before they get out for their summer recess. they come out with all the big controversial cases. And so everybody seemed to be expecting that we were going to get a decision out of them this week on what was happening. And then they come out with some very surprising news. Walk us through how they got to the Supreme Court and what the Supreme Court has said here this week.
Sure. The McCain-Feingold allows parties that sue in federal court to have direct access to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court accepted the case, and they actually had arguments earlier in the year on the merits of the case. The FEC had the Solicitor General argue its side of the case, and then Citizens United has its legal team present their side. Briefs, of course, were submitted, and the court was expected to hand down a decision this last Monday. But in a surprise move that has really put a lot of issues in play, the Supreme Court did not issue an opinion. And that is an extremely rare move by the Supreme Court after they have already heard arguments and received briefs. Instead, what they said was they put out an order asking the parties, and this would be Citizens United and the FEC, asking for additional arguments on whether or not the court needs to revisit some of the McCain-Feingold rules, namely the electioneering communication ban, which is the statute that prohibits corporations from airing candidate ads within close proximity to federal elections, but also whether the Supreme Court, in reaching its decision, needs to overturn a case called Austin v. Michigan Chamber of Commerce.
Love that case. It's actually the first case we read in corporations class in law school.
That's right. And this is a case from back in 19, a couple of decades ago. And basically what happened there was Michigan passed a law that said corporations can't air express candidate ads about state candidates. And it was challenged by the chamber, and the Supreme Court ultimately said, yes, the state does have the authority to restrict those types of advertisements.
Now, you know, it's funny. I actually had an email exchange, Bill, this week with my professor who taught that class, who's interested in some of these issues. And he sort of indicated in that exchange that the Scalia dissent in the Austin case might be the roadmap that is used or is a centerpiece of the strategy Citizens United rolls out at this special hearing in September. And that basically, I mean, what's stunning about what the Supreme Court did here is it seems to be an invitation to argue, instead of on the narrowest grounds possible for Citizens United to get their way and be able to have this film be published, for the broadest possible ruling that says, look, all of McCain-Feingold is wrong and unconstitutional.
That's exactly right. And actually, the dissent that a lot of people have focused on, and this was written by Justice Kennedy in Austin, his dissent, he also dissented in the McConnell case, which was the case that upheld the constitutionality of McCain-Feingold. And in his McConnell dissent, Justice Kennedy also took issue with using the Austin case, as a basis for upholding the restrictions on corporate speech. And you're exactly right. The Supreme Court could have decided this case on fairly narrow grounds, limited to basically the facts surrounding Citizens United. But instead, it seems that they've opened the door for a much broader ruling. And this much broader ruling really has the potential to change the political landscape in the years to come if they actually overturn the McConnell decision on the corporate spending, but also Austin. It could expand the number of voices that you're going to hear in the political marketplace. I mean, currently what you're hearing in close proximity to elections are the advertisements by candidates, the advertisements by political party committees. You may have some individuals who sponsor independent expenditures. But really, there's been kind of a blackout period for, say, trade associations, incorporated nonprofits that are formed to advance a particular view, because they don't want to get caught up in the snare of an FEC investigation because people file complaints about these types of things.
Yeah, it seems like part of what's unique about Citizens United is you really have a convergence of technologies here. You know, they've taken an innovative approach to go out and preach a message that I think most people would consider, if not electioneering, something that's clearly intended to influence folks how they think about a particular candidate. And yet another attempt of Congress and regulators to try and catch up with something they can never catch up with, and that's the changing, evolving role of communications and technology, instead of just having a couple of clear, bright line tests.
I think that's right. And technology continues to change. I mean, look at what the state of play when the Supreme Court decided the McConnell case. The internet was around and was really beginning to get a strong foothold in the political arena. But if you look at the internet today, blogs and the ability of candidates and party committees and others who have a particular view to basically blast the point of view that they want to get across out to a large number of individuals and make it publicly accessible. I mean, political communications are changing at a rapid pace. It's not only the internet, but look at Twitter. I mean, look at the number of people who have established, politicians, organizations, and everybody else who have established Twitter accounts with a large following to basically broadcast their political views in 140 characters or 140 words or less to
That's
talk about
sentence.
You know what they're going to do.
Well, Bill, we've got just a couple minutes left. Tell me a little bit, look forward and explain to me how Citizens United fits into the larger context of debate the FEC is having about some of these political issues in front of them, and give us a sense of what you think will happen after the court hears these arguments in September. You have some huge heavyweights that are coming to bear in that hearing, and what do you think the outcome will be?
Well, with respect to the FEC, there's been a large debate within the FEC. We've had a lot of editorial boards and self-named campaign finance reform groups and others who have been lamenting that a number of enforcement actions, and these are the investigations that the FEC conducts, have actually been dismissed. And a number of them have been dismissed along party lines. The three Republican commissioners voting to dismiss, the Democratic commissioners voting to proceed with an investigation. And what the Republican commissioners have done, which I believe has been actually very beneficial to the regulated community, is they put out some very detailed and actually quite heavy statements of reasons explaining the basis for their votes. And what you're seeing is that a number of commissioners have stepped back and taken a look not only at the text of the law, the text of the regulations and the ENJs or the legislative history, but also they're taking a closer look at a lot of the federal court decisions that impact the campaign finance area, and they're asking some very fundamental questions. And it's a healthy debate. What should the reach of the federal election laws be? You know, what type of punishment should be levied against those who make inadvertent mistakes? These are very fundamental questions in the political arena. With respect to the case, I think you're going to see a very spirited and robust debate before the Supreme Court on the issues that they've laid out for re-argument. I think you're going to see a lot of friend of the court briefs being weighed in by organizations and individuals on both sides of these issues. And it really has the potential to be a blockbuster case if the court decides to rule in favor of Citizens United and overturn the Austin decision, but also invalidate the electioneering communication rules in McCain-Feingold. In litigation, it's always very difficult to forecast, you know, what decision the court's going to make.
Right.
But
well,
in this matter,
there
seems
to
be a pretty clear signal that they want
to
at least examine these issues, and there's the potential for this to be a blockbuster.
Well, we will get you back on later this summer to talk about it some more. We've been joined by Bill McGinley, campaign finance expert, talking about the Citizens United case before the Supreme Court. We'll be back to talk about the Ricci case right after this.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No more candy.
even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORAKID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. We promised we were going to spend half this show talking about two of the more significant Supreme Court decisions of this week. We just talked about campaign finance reform, and now we're going to talk about the Ricci case, which involves employment discrimination. And our guest is a prior guest here on the show. That's Doug Mishkin, head of the Employment Law Practice Group at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C. And Doug is kind enough to interrupt his vacation up in New York State to join us and talk about the significance of Monday's decision in this case. Doug, welcome back to the show.
How are you, Kevin?
Terrific. Well, listen, let's start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about these firefighters, who they are, and what happened to them that led them to court.
Well, the city of New Haven used a written examination as part of a process to determine which firefighters would be promoted. So in 2003, they gave the exam to firefighters who hoped to qualify for promotions either to lieutenant or captain. Some numbers here might be helpful. 77 firefighters took the lieutenant exam, and of the 43 whites who took it, 16 passed. Of the 19 blacks who took it, 3 passed. Of the 15 Hispanics who took it, 3 passed. There were 41 firefighters who took the captain's examination. Of the 25 whites, 16 passed. Of the 8 blacks who took it, 3 passed. Of the 8 Hispanics, 3 passed. So based on those results, when they were applied to the other rules of the city's Civil Service Board, it meant the following, that of the 8 vacant lieutenant positions, all of those positions would go to whites. And for the 7 vacant captain positions, well, the top 9 candidates for those 7 positions were going to be 7 whites and 2 Hispanics. Namely, no blacks were slated to be promoted to either lieutenant or captain based on these results. So there was a heated public debate when the results were announced. And some said if the city certifies these results and makes promotion decisions accordingly, well, there'll be a lawsuit claiming race discrimination. And others said if the city does not go forward with the promotions under these tests, well, there'll be a lawsuit claiming race discrimination.
It sounds like heartburn for the general counsel of the city.
It was a tough spot to be in. So ultimately, the city's 5-member civil service board entertained a motion to certify the examinations. 2 members voted to certify the exams, 2 members voted not to certify, and surely 1 member was recused. So with the 2-2 vote, the results were not certified and no promotions were made. So there was a lawsuit. The plaintiffs were 17 white and 1 Hispanic firefighters who had passed the test, and they sued saying this was race discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The city moved for summary judgment in the district court, and the district court granted that motion, saying these tests did have a racially disparate result, and it was not discrimination for the city to set aside the results in the interest of avoiding a race discrimination claim.
And it was a split court, right? I mean, 5-4, it wouldn't have taken much to go the other way?
Well, when we got to the Supreme Court, it was a 5-4 split. The district court grant of summary judgment went up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which did include in its three-judge panel Supreme Court nominee Judge Sotomayor. That three-judge panel affirmed the grant of summary judgment. Then the Supreme Court granted cert, and yes, the Supreme Court's decision was a 5-4 split with a familiar group of five, Justice Kennedy writing for the majority on behalf of Justices Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and Chief Justice Roberts. The case does highlight the difference between two kinds of discrimination that are prohibited by Title VII. One is what we call disparate treatment. That's when the employer says, I'm not hiring you because of your race. The other kind of theory of discrimination is what's referred to as disparate impact. Namely, we're using this criterion, say a test, it disproportionately excludes people of this race or that race or age or other protected category. So the majority said, well, this test did have a racially disparate impact on opportunities for blacks for promotions, but the key, according to the majority, was it said an employer can only use race to avoid that disparate impact if the employer has, and these are the words of the court, a strong basis in evidence to believe it will be subject to disparate impact liability if it fails to set aside the test results. Now, here, the city rejected the test results because the higher scoring candidates were white, and according to the majority, the city could be liable for disparate impact discrimination only if those exams were not job-related and consistent with business necessity, or if there were an equally valid, less discriminatory way to serve the city's needs. And the majority said the record in this case shows the exams were job-related and there was no equally valid way to do what the city was trying to accomplish. So the city shouldn't worry. It would not be liable for discrimination if it certified the tests. And the majority said, look, there were firefighters who passed the test, and they had invested time and money and effort, and that they had a legitimate expectation that those results would be implemented.
Well, Doug, since the decision came out, I have seen sort of follow-up information all over the map. And so I want to put myself in the shoes of a guy who's a CEO or CFO or chief human HR officer at a company, and ask you, what does this case mean for me as an employer?
Well, that's the important question, but I think anyone who's motivated to ask the question has to keep in mind, when we have a Supreme Court ruling of 5-4 on the last day of the term with a majority decision of 34 pages and a dissent that goes on for 39 pages, it was issued on June 29th. It means it's summer reading, but it's not light summer reading, and we should all be aware of relatively instant analysis. Having said that, I think it's reasonably clear that what it does mean for employers is if you're using a written examination for promotion or perhaps even for hiring purposes, and you're thinking about not using the results of your exam because the results have a disparate impact on a minority, well, you ought to think twice before setting aside those results. In addition, the case tells us something that we do already know, which is we have to pay close attention to whether a test has been validated for the purpose for which an employer is using it. The majority put a lot of stock in the fact that this test had been validated for the purpose it was being used for, and the dissent was clearly skeptical about that.
Yeah, they're definitely, in reading the opinion, you see two very different worldviews of the facts, which, obviously, if you can't agree on the facts, it's pretty difficult to reach agreement on the law. You said this is not light summer reading, and it sure doesn't sound like something I want to read over the 4th of July holidays just for kicks. My question is this much to do about nothing, or is there really a lot here that is going to cause me as an employer to sit up, take notice, and change my behavior?
Oh, I think it's not much ado about nothing. Anytime the Supreme Court addresses issues of discrimination, it's important. And anytime the court addresses discrimination in the workplace, that's important for employers. But I do think it's important to keep this decision in perspective. And let me offer this. Just yesterday, namely 2 days after the Supreme Court ruled in the firefighter case, there was a decision out of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals that ruled that an employee who makes a purely oral complaint is not protected by the retaliation provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act, the act that requires payment of overtime in appropriate circumstances. And the Seventh Circuit said that this retaliation provision only protects employees who make written complaints because of certain language in the Fair Labor Standards Act. And this ruling means that the Seventh Circuit and the Fourth Circuit use one approach to that issue, and that approach is in conflict with the approach of the Sixth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit. My point is this. Every day, employers face issues of whether employees are properly characterized as exempt or non-exempt under the FLSA, and every day employees are disagreeing about pay practices. A case like the Seventh Circuit case and similar cases with similar or different results, I think, are much more likely to affect an employer's practices and potential legal liability. Decision about a municipal fire department setting aside the racially disparate results of a written exam for promotion.
I note, Doug, we got just a minute here to wrap up, but I note Scalia in particular had a line that's been quoted in many papers that essentially the court was just kicking the can down the road on the big decision to come about whether or not you could engage in this type of activity at all in the future.
Well, Justice Scalia is interested in how the Equal Protection Clause applies to all this. There was a claim under the Equal Protection Clause which the court did not address because, as a matter of constitutional jurisprudence, the court won't address constitutional issues if it doesn't have to reach a result. And here the majority felt it was not necessary to reach that issue.
Gotcha. Well, Doug, if folks want to get in contact with you, why don't you shoot us your email information here so that they could follow up with you with questions?
dmishkin@patentbogs.com, and I'd be happy to get them.
All right. That's dmishkin, D-M-I-S-H-K-I-N, at patentbogs.com. We've been joined by Doug Mishkin, employment attorney at Patton Boggs, talking about this exciting case the Supreme Court decided this week. We're going to be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking right here on the Voice America Network.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet talk radio, Voice America Business Network.
Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Welcome back. We are chatting a little bit now about changes in the regulatory environment due to the new president, new Congress, more intent on regulating many different industries. And our focus in this segment is on natural resources and energy development, particularly out in the West. Our guest is Carolyn McIntosh. She's a partner in the Denver office of the law firm of Patton Boggs, where she specializes in energy, natural resources, and environmental counseling. Carolyn, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm just fine. Thank you, Kevin.
Well, listen, we do want to talk about some of the changes that are going on, sea changes, really, at the federal and state level as it comes to oil and gas development and renewable and alternative energies. President Obama actually signed the Stimulus Act at an alternative energy plant outside of Denver there just a couple months ago, and it's doing everything he can to shift the focus away from traditional fossil fuels. So tell us a little bit about the federal or state policy changes that have occurred in the last 6 months, and what's their impact on independent oil and gas development and production?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm in the Denver office of Patton Boggs, and Denver has a concentration of independent oil and gas producers. That is because we have in Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, throughout the Rocky Mountain West, that's where oil and gas deposits in the western United States tend to be. So those independent oil and gas producing companies, many of them have been hit with kind of a double whammy of the recession as well as federal and state policy changes. Specifically with respect to the recession, the gas prices and petroleum product prices have been depressed because predominantly Americans are driving less. Summer pricing tends to be a little bit lower anyway, because gas is used more in the western United States, is used more for indoor heating, and there's less demand for it there during the summer. So we have depressed pricing, and then we have federal and state policy changes. On the federal level, as soon as the Obama administration came in and then appointed Secretary Salazar as the Secretary of Interior, one of his first acts, I believe on the first or second day of office, was to revoke and narrow some oil and gas leases. And we, if we have a moment to go into the process of leasing, in order for an oil or gas lease to be issued on the federal level, the agency that is managing the land that is being leased, and certainly throughout the western United States, we have the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Park Service, a substantial portion of oil and gas development is actually on federally owned lands. And as a federal agency, they must go through environmental review under the National Environmental Policy Act before making a determination that a particular area is leasable for any purpose, but certainly for natural resource development. In addition, there are procedures for Forest Service, for BLM, for each of the federal agencies as to how they make their land management decisions, and that requires, any amendment requires a proposed plan being submitted and noticed in the Federal Register, comment period, and then finalizing that. And so, as you might imagine, this is a very lengthy process, often a multi-year process, to reach a determination that a particular area can be is available for oil and gas leasing.
And the Obama administration, you said in their opening days, narrowed the interpretation of what might be open in the future, meaning it's a long, difficult road just to get into those available fields compared to what might have been available, say, under the Bush administration?
Well, and in fact, the Bush administration had identified certain lands in Colorado and Utah specifically for oil and gas leasing by going through that process. And I've read that in a couple of these areas, it was a six-year process to finally identify the property that was made available for lease. And then the leasing process is a competitive bid. So the area is identified by the federal managing agency. Parties that are interested submit bids, and then there's they submit bids to a deadline, and then there's a bid opening process, and the leases are awarded to the highest bidder. Well, that process had actually been undertaken and under the Bush administration, and leases had been issued to a number of companies in, as I said, Colorado and Utah specifically, when the Obama administration came in and made a determination that some of those lands under lease were not going to be available and the leases were revoked.
Well, let's talk about that. We talk a lot about federal regulation. Aren't oil and gas pricing and production figures sort of impacted by state and local government factors as well?
Yes, absolutely. And in Colorado specifically, we had a change in the oil and gas regulations, and those just went into effect in the spring of this year, such that in order to for management of an oil or gas lease and production of oil or gas on a lease, there are substantial additional reporting requirements, additional environmental control requirements, and restrictions from a land management standpoint that we saw over 1,000 lease applications and lease decisions made in April, and then a substantial drop-off. We've also seen in the last 6 months, by this combination of federal and state impacts, half of the number of oil and gas rigs, that would be rigs to drill wells, half the number that were deployed last year are in the field this year. And in addition to just the regulatory climate, of course, any operating oil and gas well or field or lease is subject to a wide variety of requirements. I've touched on those. The agency, the federal agency that is managing the property under lease, has obligations for environmental protection, for reporting, and has deadlines for wells to be drilled and production requirements. So to talk about that a little bit, once a lease is issued, it will be issued subject to conditions. Typically, there's a 1 to 2 year period in which the lease awardee or the leaseholder must drill exploratory wells. And depending upon the conditions, it might be one well, it might be two wells, and then on a specific time frame. If the wells are not installed, then the lease gets revoked unless there's extenuating circumstances that the leaseholder can demonstrate. Once a well is drilled and is producing, then the production should hold the lease unless there are additional well requirements over time, and sometimes that's the case.
I see. And tell us, I know you've been engaged in some pretty significant disputes, including one that you just won. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. In addition to all the regulatory problems, there's always the question of, do you have neighbors that dispute your land use, or are there simply disputed uses already in place? And we did just win a case. We don't have the final orders, but we have a ruling from the court, And let me give you a little bit of background on that first. Our client, an independent oil and gas company in Denver, acquired, back in 2001, acquired a series of producing oil and gas leases in Carbon County, Utah. Now, that included leases, it included wells, it included the ability to drill additional wells, and it included a gas gathering pipeline, meaning that the pipeline was there for wells to produce into, and then ultimately the pipeline would produce up to a collection point for production into the commercial market. And the properties had been leased back in the 50s, and the pipeline itself was, portions of it were nearly 50 years old. So this was a proven property, but it needed substantial upgrade, including the pipeline upgrade. And because it was an existing property, our client bought these assets, and there had been four or five prior owners. One of the previous owners of several of the leases had, back in the mid-90s to late-90s, had financial issues that resulted in, first, it selling off portions of leases, and then, secondly, there were a judgment lien and two contractor service contractor, like a pipeline service contractor, liens, because they had not been paid by this previous owner. As a consequence, there was a foreclosure and sale, sheriff sale, of one well and several leases in the middle of the property that was acquired by our client. In conjunction with the acquisition, as anyone would do in a standard real estate purchase or certainly in buying producing oil and gas properties, the client did due diligence and identified this foreclosure sale and the existence of the one lease and, I mean, one well, and the possibility of some disputes with the owner that had acquired the property in the foreclosure. But the feeling was that it was one well, it could be either purchased or the client could manage around it, and frankly, the seller was required by contract to make efforts to resolve the dispute before our client took possession of the property. That did not occur, and the client had not fully evaluated the scale or magnitude of the risk involved with this dispute.
Well, Carol, let me stop you there. I want to get your email address out to folks real fast. Who might want to follow up with you on this issue. You want to throw that out?
It's cmcintosh@pattenbogs.com.
Right. Well, we will have you back sometime soon to talk a little bit more about the risks involved for this sector of the economy and what those companies can do to protect themselves against that risk. We'll be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking here on the Voice America Business Network.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, the 4th of July is coming up in just 48 hours, and I can tell you one American citizen who is going to be happy to be home on American soil celebrating our freedom. That is American lawyer Emanuel Zeltzer. Now, frequent listeners of the show will know we've talked about Mr. Zeltzer earlier this spring. We had some lawyers on to talk about his case. This is a guy who was basically wrongfully imprisoned in Belarus and accused of economic espionage and traveling with forged documents. Now, he denied all those charges, and he alleged that he had been placed in a prison camp and that all kinds of bad things were happening to him. He was in very poor health with diabetes and a heart ailment. Well, this week, great news. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has pardoned Emanuel Zeltzer. That's due in part to some great work by the lawyers, also the folks at the Department of State who worked with some members of Congress to get Mr. Zeltzer freed. Zeltzer had been very active in looking in his role at the American-Russian Law Institute, in looking into organized crime in the former Soviet states and the issues of money laundering over there and ties to all kinds of bad activities. So let's hear for the Department of State that probably doesn't get enough recognition. I saw some blurbs in the paper about this guy getting released, but congratulations to Emanuel Zeltzer. Good Guys Awards to folks like Ben Cardin, Democratic Senator from Maryland, Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, Congressman Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey, all of whom worked very hard through various diplomatic channels to see that Emanuel Zeltzer is home and free on American soil and getting the medical treatment he deserves. So, Emanuel Zeltzer, happy 4th of July to you. Now, let's talk about some of the key issues of the day here in D.C. Well, first and foremost, the president's poll ratings are slipping. Rasmussen polls report that for the first time since he took office, the president has more citizens who strongly disapprove of his job performance than strongly approve of his performance. Now, his overall job rating continues to be high, just around the 57% to 58% mark if you look at the average. But if you start to look again at those numbers of people who are very dissatisfied compared to very satisfied, for the first time he is below, he's got more that don't like his performance than do like him. And that's pretty significant. It means the president's got a lot of work to do in the next few weeks to get some of his accomplishments not only through the United States Congress before they recess for the summer, but also explain to the American people in a way that they buy them. There's a lot of negative feedback to last week's cap and trade bill that passed the House to suggest that, yes, Democrats got a victory. The president got a victory. He got something through the House that he very much wants, but that the American public think, well, that's not really such a good thing for me. I'm not sure that doing the things that will need to be done in that bill will make a difference in the environment or not hurt the economy more than they help the environment. Now, the president had a town hall here in Northern Virginia just yesterday to talk about his issue of health care reform, which is the number one issue he'll be working on in the month of July. And he's gotten a great deal of criticism from the press in the last 48 hours about the construction and execution of that event, basically an event that seems to have been packed with supporters of his, where the questions may not have been pre-screened, but the people who got to ask them were only staunch supporters of the president's view. Nobody there to question the wisdom of the president's direction. And in fact, you know, there have been news articles to suggest that everybody who got to ask a question is someone who works for an advocacy group that is directly tied to the president and his agenda, including one of the questioners who actually works for the successor organization to Barack Obama for president, 2008. So not a disinterested party to say the least. Now, I remember back when President Bush got a lot of criticism for having events on the road in his election campaign and when he was president and for packing it with supporters. And there was a great deal of press outrage and criticism about that that was valid then and is valid now. If the president of the United States can't sit in a room and hear from a citizen who disagrees with his perspective and beat back Joe Sixpack, or Susie Homemaker when she questions whether or not what he's doing is the right thing, that's not the guy for the job. So if the president really wants to change his ratings and he really wants to get people convinced that what he's doing is the right thing, let's get him in a room with 100 skeptics and let's see how many of them he can convince he's doing the right thing. Mr. President, don't be afraid of the American people. We actually know what we're talking about. And we'd love to meet with you in an unstructured environment where we could tell you why we think we might be headed down the wrong road on a couple things, and we might be able to praise you on the instances where we think you are doing the right thing. Let's not get you in a room. You already live in a bubble, surrounded by people whose only job is to please you and make sure that you get your way. That's not the way to do your best job for the American people. Well, speaking of people not doing a good job, our thoughts turn again to the great state of South Carolina. Governor Mark Sanford enters the second week of what can only be described as a siege on his abilities to continue serving as governor after admissions that he had conducted an affair in South America with another woman. Now, you talk about textbook cases of how not to handle a crisis. First, there was last week's rambling discourse about his affair, where he told us it only happened a couple times and only with this woman. Then this week, he's got a very long interview with the AP where he says, oh, I crossed the line with other women. And, oh, yeah, this affair that I admitted to went on for a lot longer than I admitted. And it happened here in the United States, not just in Argentina. Oh, Governor Sanford, that is not the way to handle the crisis. If you are trying to gain back your credibility with folks, showing them that you are lying about the lies ain't the way to make it happen. Now, I understand from press reports in the last 24 hours, both senators from the state of South Carolina and one of the congressmen, one of the guys who's actually running to succeed the governor next year, have called to weigh in with the governor, and it seems to be reading between the lines that they've asked for him to step down. Certainly, Congressman Gresham Barrett has asked him to step down. There are a majority or close to a majority of the state Senate Republicans in the state of South Carolina who have asked him now to step down. You've got an investigation going on. I can't imagine that he's got much more than a couple days left in office before he's simply going to face the prospect of choosing to resign or choosing for them to start a process that ends with him being pushed out of office. It's a fascinating and swift fall from grace for someone that many thought would be a front runner for the presidential nomination in 3 years, and frankly is a guy who may have trouble figuring out his next move after he is swept out of office here, if not in the next days, then certainly in a series of sort of shameful acts 18 months from now. So Governor Sanford, best wishes to you, and again to Mrs. Sanford, who seems to have only handled this with class and grace and dignity.
I know the people of South Carolina, they've got a lot of challenges, one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, lots of things they need fixing. They need somebody who can focus full-time on their issues. So we got a lot of members of Congress out and about this week, out talking on the road, Republicans and Democrats getting vastly different talking points as they're at home, Democrats talking about the successes that they've had in passing the cap-and-trade bill last week, about the impact, the positive impact of the stimulus bill, etc. Republicans countering with some painful facts. New unemployment figures out today, pegging the national unemployment rate at 9.5%. Remember, President Obama said if we pass this stimulus, we will stay under 8%. That hasn't happened. We are clearly headed for double-digit unemployment figures at the end, if not next month, certainly by the end of the third quarter. Everybody expects us to be in double digits, and unfortunately to probably stay in double digits for quite a while. So we're reaching an interesting political tipping point where the congressional majority, which is now a supermajority in the Senate for Democrats, they're going to have to get some tangible accomplishments made here in the next 60 days. They're going to have to get credit for them, and people are going to have to feel the country's moving in the right direction or else the Democrats are going to stop to see bad things happen to them politically. We'll be back next week. Everybody have a great 4th of July. Till then, keep it here on the Voice America Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.